So this morning we're continuing a series on key teaching and themes of the Anabaptist tradition. At Living Water, our Mennonite identity is not always up front and center, so we're taking some time to explore that and some key themes that are outlined in the book, The Naked Anabaptist. He outlines 8 core convictions of Anabaptism, and today we're looking at the 6 of those teachings. So, spirituality and economics are interconnected. In an individualist and consumerist culture, and in a world where economic injustice is rife, we are committed to finding ways of living simply, sharing generously, caring for creation, and working for justice. So I approach this topic with a little bit of trepidation. I'm not Mennonite. I've been learned a lot in the time I've been a part of this congregation, but I still feel myself very much an outsider to the Anabaptist theological tradition. And another reason for trepidation is while I hold to these values and seek to live them out, as I read that statement, I'm aware that I fall short of those values in a lot of ways. And I'm aware that there are people in this community that are role models for me in living out these values. And I think there's some trepidation as well in general, because in our culture, talking about money and how we earn it and how we spend it can be a kind of uncomfortable topic. And if thinking about this domain of life stirs some discomfort for you, I'd encourage you to just take a moment and find out where that is for you and where that sits for you. I've already mentioned the sense of having that disconnect between our values and our everyday lives that I sometimes experience. But we can also experience fear of not having enough, guilt, jealousy, shame, being ashamed for what we have or what we don't have. And maybe this is an area where you experience a lot of joy and contentment and gratitude, which is great. But my guess is that for a lot of us that we have some complicated feelings when we start thinking about interconnecting our spirituality and our economics. So in the book, The Naked Anabaptist, in this section when the author Stuart Murray is writing on this core conviction, he raises some criticisms of the way Christians have often talked about money. And one of the key symbols or ideas that Christians have often used in talking about money is the idea of tithing. Tithing was an ancient Hebrew practice where people would give 1/10 of their income back to God. And that was used for the support of the priests who didn't have land of their own or for other ritual and community needs. So often we've talked about continuing this practice of tithing into our contemporary context, which raises a lot of good and interesting questions. Should we aim for that 10% threshold? Should we be tithing more or less than that? And how do we get to that number? Who do we decide to give our money to a church, to charity, to some other worthy organization, to individuals we know who have needs? And should we give 10% of our other resources, like our time, our gifts? So there's a lot of good and interesting questions, both theological and practical, if we're thinking about the practice of tithing in our contemporary world. But what this conviction points out and what the author points out in the book is that if we want to really bring together our spirituality and our economics, that the idea of tithing is not enough to address all the problems and questions that come into this domain of our lives. So the problem, which you maybe have anticipated by now, is that we can tithe 10% of our income or whatever number it is we decide to tithe, but what are we to do with the other 90%? I wonder if sometimes churches have made a bargain with people that will ask you to give us some portion of your income so that we can continue our work or mission, and we won't ask you any of the questions about all the rest of your money. But I think those are important questions to ask. What about that other 90%? and the questions about our lifestyles and deciding what we need or what we want. Tithing doesn't address, doesn't lead us necessarily to greater accountability or shared decision-making. As this core conviction points out, we're in a very individualist and consumerist culture where we make decisions about money often privately or even secretively. And tithing doesn't lead us out of that into a more shared decision-making situation. And also, tithing does not confront me with questions about where my wealth came from, how it worked through the economic system to be in my hands, or who or what may have been harmed in that wealth coming to me. So I think this is a really important contribution that Anabaptists have to offer to the broader Christian church and to the world, is the notion that if we're just talking about giving 10% or some other percent of our money, that's not enough. That tithing may be a wonderful practice, but it doesn't address the conditions that create the needs or inequalities that we seek to address through sharing. So I think that's why it's so important to bring in living simply, sharing generously, caring for creation, and working for justice. So I'll touch on each of these last four values. Living simply gets at our lifestyles and the decisions we make about how we use our resources from day to day, and big and small decisions. And I have a sense in the years that I've been a part of this community that living simply is a shared value among us, even though we practice it in a lot of different ways and have made different decisions about how to live that out. But I have a sense that there are a lot of conversations among us about what it means to live simply and how we make those decisions. And while it's not easy, I think it's a practice through which many of us find great joy. And of course, living simply leads us to the next value by creating maybe more opportunities for sharing generously. Now, I have to confess that for a long time, I had this in my head. I thought it said giving generously. And I was working with that idea for a little while as I was writing this sermon. And then it was after that I came back and I saw that, no, it actually says sharing generously, not giving generously. And I recognize that is a really big difference, because giving, if I'm talking about giving, there's an uneven relationship, right, of a giver and a recipient. And I, when I'm thinking about giving, I'm seeing myself in the role of the giver, not in the role of the person who is the receiver. So the language of sharing points us toward a much more reciprocal and mutual relationship where I'm both sharing and being shared with. And also when we talk about sharing, it breaks down the sense of my ownership of what belongs to me, right? It's not me giving to you out of my possessions, my belongings. It's me sharing with you something that belongs to both of us. And then caring for creation. It's easy for me, maybe it's easy for you too, to forget that all the wealth we have and consume, the food we eat, the clothes we wear, the houses we live in, the fuel in our cars and planes, the toys we play with, that all of this comes from the earth, the natural world. Our economic system is built to harness natural resources for our human consumption as efficiently as possible. And yet, many of us know that there is a meaning to our natural environment beyond what serves for immediate use or consumption. And finally, working for justice. It's one thing to care for creation and live simply and share generously, but this points to the fact that God's justice demands a reckoning of the systems that exploit and pollute and enslave. And this is where I feel most out of my depth, because the systems that seem to be so entrenched and so powerful that it's hard for me to know where to start in taking meaningful action. So that's where I'm really glad that we act as a community and that there are others who can show me the way. Now I want to turn to the parable in Matthew 25, verses 14 through 30, which was acted out for us earlier. It's a passage that churches that follow the lectionary will read later in the fall. And it's also a story that is very difficult, has always been very difficult for me to understand, and I've always found it very challenging. So I selected that in hopes that having this challenging teaching alongside a challenging parable, working those together might point us in some helpful direction. So I have a couple of pictures of different artwork depictions of this parable. They don't necessarily match with what I'm saying, but maybe another angle for considering this morning's text. So you may know this story as the parable of the talents, is what it's often referred to. In the translation we heard this morning, the language was the master was giving out bags of gold to the servants. But in a lot of translations, you'll hear the word talents, that the master was giving the servants 5 talents, 3 talents, and 1 talent, respectively. So the word talent also happens to be an English word meaning a natural aptitude or skill. And maybe if you've heard this parable taught or preached on before, I know I've heard this, sometimes preachers have seized upon this language, the talent, to make it a message about what talents are in English, are natural gifts, skills, aptitudes, and not what talent was in this cultural context, which was a weight of measure or a unit of currency. So if we interpret it that way, then the message becomes that we all have talents, gifts, aptitudes in different measures, and we're obligated to use our talents for the glory of God and the service of others. And that's pretty straightforward meaning, right? I think we can agree that this third servant should have used his gifts, his talents, for some useful purpose. But that's not the parable that Jesus is telling us. That is not what the word talents meant in his cultural context, that talents are referring to money, and actually quite large sums of money. Some people estimate that a talent would have been many years, even decades of earnings for your typical laborer. So these servants are entrusted with magnificent sums of money, the kind of money that the ordinary person would never dream of seeing, like 20, 40, 60 years worth of earnings for a typical day laborer. We have another picture. So another problematic way to look at this story is we could see in this parable a variation of a story that is very pervasive in our culture, in our society. That's a story that that maybe we can express through this expression that people sometimes think is in the Bible, God helps those who help themselves. People often think it's in the Bible. It's not in the Bible. I think most of you already knew that. But it's a way of thinking that's very prevalent in our world. And if you were a kind of a pull yourself up by your boots, by the bootstraps kind of person, you might think when you see this parable that the first 2 servants are rewarded because they're hardworking and they're industrious and because of their ingenuity. And then this 3rd servant, I think the master even calls him lazy, you wicked and lazy servant, right? Lazy, ungrateful for the opportunity he's been given. His poverty is not an accident of his birth, but a judgment on the condition of his soul. And it's not too hard to imagine how, in this way of thinking, we might go so far as to say that this servant is a drain on society, unworthy of compassion or help. I don't think that is the meaning that Jesus intended, because it is so contrary to the kind of life that he lived and what he taught us and practiced about healing the sick and feeding the hungry and his special attention to the poor. But it's part of what makes it the text so challenging for us to understand. So what did Jesus mean in this story? And I want to take a step back. I think to make sense of this parable, we have to take a step back to see the bigger context of what Jesus is talking about in this part of Matthew. So in this part of Matthew, dealing with teachings about the end times and reminding us that Jesus is going to return and look for an accounting from his followers. So the story that immediately precedes this one in Matthew 25, the first story of Matthew 25 is the story about the 10 virgins, which maybe you know, who they take their lamps and they go to meet the bridegroom before the marriage feast. However, the bridegroom is delayed in his coming. The virgins fall asleep while they're waiting. When he comes back, it turns out that there were 5 who were wise, who brought extra oil for their lamps, and 5 who were foolish, who have run out of oil and who are locked out of the feast. So that's what comes right before the text we're looking at today. So this, having this right before, kind of sets us up that we see Jesus is like this groom whose arrival is delayed and who arrives suddenly and catches people surprised and unprepared in some cases. So that sort of sets us up to see Jesus as being like this man who goes on a trip and whose return we have to prepare for. However, this becomes a pretty frightening prospect when the conclusion of the parable sees the master casting out the third servant into utter darkness. We can go. Sorry. So we're back to this one. Okay. So it's not only the severe judgment, I think, of casting out the servant that is uncomfortable, unsettling, but it's seemingly very arbitrary judgment. You know, our servant, as portrayed by Doug earlier, was maybe a little goofy, but not not wicked, not sinister, not, you know, pretty, not evil in any way, right? The servant didn't lose the money. He didn't go out and spend it. He didn't really seemingly do anything wrong except fail to make money. But this master is a shrewd and unscrupulous businessman, and I think it always sticks out to me that when the master comes back, the servant says to him, Lord or master, I know you are a harsh man who reaps where he does not sow and gathers where he did not scatter seed. And the master doesn't contest that assessment. So it seems that this master has made a practice of earning money at the expense of others and sort of expects that his servants, who he's entrusted with his wealth, will do the same. So is Jesus like such a man? I don't think so. Jesus was far more likely. We see far many more instances of Jesus challenging the rich or calling out the rich than for calling out somebody for failing to earn a lot of money. So I don't think we can equate Jesus directly with the man in this story. Now, if we look at what comes immediately after this story about the man and his 3 servants, Matthew recounts his teaching that Jesus gave, that Jesus will come in glory and separate people as one separates sheep and goats. So Jesus says he'll return and put the sheep on one side of him and the goats on the other side. And he says to the sheep, he welcomes them into his Father's kingdom and says, for I was hungry and you gave me food. I was thirsty and you gave me drink. I was a stranger and you welcomed me. I was naked and you clothed me. I was sick and you visited me. I was in prison and you came to me. And then those sheep say to him, Lord, when did we see you sick or naked or thirsty or in prison? And Jesus says to them, whatever you did for the least of one of these children of mine, you did for me. And then Jesus, in this next story, turns to the goats and condemns them for failing to do those same things of feeding the hungry, clothing the naked, welcoming the stranger, visiting the sick and those in prison. So I think when we take those two together, the story about the separation of the sheep and the goats gives us the criteria by which Jesus, not the unscrupulous businessman, will call us to account. So Jesus is like the master, except that instead of looking for a good return on his investment, the things that matter to Jesus, his criteria are giving food, giving drink, welcoming the stranger, clothing the naked, visiting the sick, visiting those in prison, all in his name. So I wonder if we can read this not as a parable about our talents, not as being only about money, but as a parable about value and what we value. Perhaps instead of equating economics with money or finance, we could think of economics as a study of what people value and why we value those things and how we behave to orient ourselves towards those things of value. I wonder if it's maybe only a failure of our imagination that we equate economics with money instead of any of the other things that actually make our lives worth living. I think Jesus wants to tell us that there will always be this rich man whose highest value is making a profit, whatever it takes. I don't think Jesus is telling us to emulate this person. I think maybe he wants to tell us and to challenge us to be similarly single-minded in living out and seeking the things that he values. The feeding, the giving, the welcoming, the clothing, the healing, the visiting. I think Jesus wants to tell us that it is possible to miss the point of your own life. And maybe we're too tempted to be like this third servant, who is so afraid that in seeking to secure his own well-being, he lost everything. And for all the ways that Jesus is not like the master, Jesus is also not very like this third servant. Jesus was not very security-oriented, not very concerned for his own physical or material well-being, and not very interested about preserving the way of life of his people or his community. So both this parable and this core conviction, this theme from the Anabaptist tradition, challenge us and challenge the world, I think, to live more wholeheartedly towards the things that matter most to Jesus. To orient our lives and our institutions and our world towards things of true value. Not toward gross domestic product as the kingdoms of our day measure success. But maybe toward joy and kindness, justice, peace, friendship, or even love. And to live so that one day we may also hear Jesus saying to us, "For I was hungry and you gave me food. I was thirsty and you gave me drink. I was a stranger and you welcomed me. I was naked and you clothed me. I was sick and you visited me. I was in prison and you came to me. Truly I tell you, just as you did for one of the least of these, you did for me." Amen.